If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's episode, we're bringing you a fascinating conversation with a winner of this year's Dan David Prize. The prize, of which History Extra is a media partner, recognises outstanding scholarship that illuminates the past and seeks to anchor public discourse in a deeper understanding of history. Today's guest is Dr. Christina Richardson. Christina is Associate Professor of History at Queen's College and the Graduate Centre of City University of New York. Her research looks at how one itinerant medieval Middle Eastern community was highly advanced in printing on paper long before it was adopted in the West. Speaking to Christina was the author, broadcaster and public historian Helen Carr, who's working with us on this series.
Professor Christina Richardson, I'm delighted to welcome you to the BBC History Extra podcast as one of the 2022 Dan David Prize winners. Your expertise is based around many things, but primarily the Mamluk and Ottoman history, but also disability and literary history, which is what I'm going to mostly be focusing on for this podcast. With amongst all of these different areas and disciplines, could you introduce yourself and perhaps describe your research in a little more detail, but also adding what drew you to it?
Sure. And thank you, Helen, for having me on the podcast. I guess I would describe myself. My research does range pretty far, I mean, temporally and also thematically. So from the 9th century to the 16th century in the central Islamic lands, so basically from Egypt, Iraq, and Syria, and the Arabian Peninsula for the most part. Thematically, I do focus on non-elites. I have to say that's a thread that has run maybe with one or two exceptions in all of my work. I really thrill to learning about the lives and experiences and influences of people who just did not hold a lot of power. So I'm not interested in courts and kings and queens. I'm sorry, but my work tends to go towards disabled people in the Middle East. Blue-eyed people were a pretty denigrated category. So I work on blue-eyed people, also the Roma and craft workers. So that's basically where my work has been.
What inspired you to work on that?
I think I like to work in a field by myself. I actually feel like that's something, I find it very hard to react to make interventions based on long series of research. So with the Roma, for instance, in the Middle Ages, there is, nothing has been written since 1903, and that was written in French. That means not a lot of Americans were reading it anyway. And so, it was really new in my field. As for blue-eyed people, there had been nothing before. So I think there's something about just being able to make a statement and then field reactions. Like that for me feels a lot easier than intervening.
Which does actually lead me into something that I think is fascinating. And it's a discovery or a key argument you're making in your most recent work, which is that an itinerant Middle Eastern community were highly advanced in printing on paper long before it was adopted in the West, later most famously pioneered by Johannes Gutenberg in the late 15th century. But so who were these people? And can you explain some of these early print processes?
Absolutely. So I'm looking at a group that actually is broader than the Roma. So in Arabic, the term is ghuraba, which literally translates to foreigners or to strangers. Some refer to them as strangers today. And so this was a very capacious category. So it was, yes, the Roma, but also other traveling communities like the Nawar and the Halab, for those, you know, listeners who might know these groups, and the Dome and the Loam. So speakers of very many different kinds of languages, all unified by a shared lifestyle. So a rejection of majority values like property ownership or learning a craft that that would sustain a community, like agriculture or, you know, butchery. And so these people, it appears that at least since the 10th century, and this information is not only from their own sources, but also from contemporary Arabic sources and Persian sources that state that they had monopolized effectively the craft of block printing in, so from, again, from the 10th to the 15th centuries. And so what they did, according to them, they carved pieces of wood, of course, in mirror format, backwards text, and they record their ink recipes that they used to, you know, paint the wood and then stamp paper. They also claim that they carved tin, and they must have had a different ink recipe. I haven't found that. It must have had an oil base to it to stick to the metal, but also using that to print on paper. So the Chinese and Buddhists, of course, for a couple of centuries before, Middle Easterners had been, you know, had been printing on paper. So they were not the first, but they seem to have inherited this tradition from East Asians and especially Buddhist communities.
So much of this appears to be down to their communal shared interest in traveling and moving and changing spaces. If you're talking about the way that they adopted this printing process, how that then also enabled them to spread it further. I mean, what do we know about their sort of travel routes? And did these communities bring some of their cultures and practices to Europe at any point?
So I should say my sources are biased towards the more sedentary groups of these strangers. There are references to movement throughout the Middle East, but they, you know, when they settle, they appear to tend to write and recite their poetry and their theater and their plays. So I could say that they're moving between settled communities. They're basically very dependent, all of these traveling communities, dependent on settled peoples for their sustenance. So they don't make or produce their own food. The shelter they seem to have is either very precarious or they're living in abandoned buildings, in large groups and abandoned buildings in the city. So that seems to be the movement, I guess. Just from city to city, but sometimes settling in these cities outside of the city walls, or again, in abandoned communities within city walls. As for breaking their culture into Europe, this is what got me thinking in the first place about maybe how did their own cultures in the Middle East maybe impact their lives in Europe. So in the 1410s, this is our first mention of Romani peoples entering into Central Europe. So they certainly were in the Balkans and Southeastern Europe for centuries before that in Ottoman territories. But coming into Southern Germany in 1417, this is where we begin to understand a little bit more about, about their lifestyles, because the records, I should say, from townspeople, from observers, are a little clearer than they were, at least in the Middle Ages in the Middle East. So what they brought, as I argue, is that they probably brought block printing technology with them. So a very old technology for them, 5 centuries old at this point. They seem to have brought that along their route.
What sort of literature were they printing? And would you say that there are various types of cultural and linguistic influences within it, or would you say that it is more of a more unique to their personal cultures? I mean, for example, do you get influences of other languages within it?
Oh, sure. Well, as for what they were printing, they seem to have mostly printed exclusively religious texts, let's say that. Most of what I've been finding are excerpts from the Quran or prayers, not in the Quran, but, you know, very typical prayers that an average Muslim would recognize. They also, however, and so those are printed in Arabic. They also print a little bit in Greek, a little bit in Coptic, a little bit in Hebrew, and also Syriac. And in those languages, they're printing Christian and Jewish religious texts. So in Hebrew, we have, you know, an excerpt from Psalms. In Greek, we also have another excerpt from Psalms. Also in Hebrew, a portion of Deuteronomy. So there seemed to have been a wide sense of literacy and an understanding of broad cultural or religious traditions. I think, and this doesn't point to the fact, you know, that they maybe subscribed to all of these faiths. They seem to have been first and foremost, you know, printing these amulets to sell them. And so to sell to the widest possible population, you know, they could not just focus on one faith tradition or linguistic tradition. It was quite wide. And in addition to that, and I'm not sure the strangers were actually printing this next, we also have printed pilgrimage certificates for pilgrimages to Mecca. So I'm not entirely sure the strangers were doing that, but that's another form of, I guess, religious related printing. But all of it was faith related. I have to say, I mean, even from East Asia, Central Asia, and West Asia, which I work on, all of these early texts were entirely religious. So
yeah, I think that really applies for, I would say, 90% of medieval texts. I mean, unless you're looking at, you know, the odd piece, especially when it, you know, much later on in late 14th century, when you start to see kind of stories and fables and things printed, like, well, not printed, but produced. It's certainly most things were religious, weren't they? If you're thinking more traditionally in Europe about things like Books of Hours, etc., it would make sense that the amount that people were investing in that type of religious material, that these people were producing them and in order to sell them and make a very successful trade, I assume.
Exactly. Yes.
Do you think that's how they emerged? Block printing emerged in Europe. Would you say that it was through these, so the buying and selling of these different texts that happened?
With that question, I have to fall a little bit into conjecture because I don't, but I do think that when they presented themselves in Southern Europe in 14 to 17, I mean, certainly they did present themselves as former Muslims. They'd converted to Christianity because they kept flip-flopping in their faith. Their bishop ordered them to wander for 7 years. So they were wandering in penance. And so they received these safe conduct letters that allowed them to circulate in Bavaria, basically unmolested, and also having access to alms and to food and beer. And it seems pretty clear that the earliest prints, at least in Southern Europe, were appearing in monasteries, and they were certainly preserved in monasteries. And so I wonder if, as the, you know, they're claiming to be Christian penance or penitents, that they were maybe approaching these cloistered communities, maybe producing these printed works for them or showing them how to print. And so I don't know if it was buying and selling. I don't know if it was gifting in exchange for shelter. You know, I don't know. But there seems to be a very, at least for me, it felt very clear that there was this contact with cloistered people. And this is where the printing took place. And the earliest prints, I should say, in Southern Europe, were of images of saints, right? So not yet printing words. Words come pretty soon afterwards, but the earliest ones are just images. So
you just mentioned 1417, and I wanted to ask you about this because, you know, why was this? And I think you've just answered it in part. But why was it such a crucial time for block printing in Europe? And at what moment did this change everything? And I mean, do you think it perhaps influenced that later move away from manuscript culture?
Well, 1417 is just the first official record we have. So this is when a man named Duke Michael of Egypt, that's how he called himself, that he approached King Sigismund as he was attending the Council of Constance, in the city of Constance on the lake. And he apparently requested a safe conduct letter. And in the Imperial Register, it says, you know, on a specific date in March of 1417, that Duke Michael was granted this safe conduct letter. So I do believe, you know, that they were probably circulating a little bit before that as well, maybe taking time to learn the local hierarchies and power structures before they approach the highest, you know, political figure in the land for protection. You know, these early block prints seem to be the earliest that we know of, I should say, in Europe. It's usually not integrated into the Gutenberg story. I actually found that very interesting as I was just looking into how Europeanists construct the history of print. And it always starts with Gutenberg in the mid-1450s with the Bible and his calendar and his Latin grammar book. And those works are fantastic and they're beautiful. But there's this long, you know, at least 30 years of printing before him that really is not integrated into this. And I'm still not entirely sure why. I have some ideas, but I do think it's important. I do say, I think in the book that, you know, as the Roma were migrating northward, they did pass through the city of Erfurt at the same time that Gutenberg was a student in the city at the university of, or he was presumed to have studied there. So there was a possibility that, I don't know, but you know, that's, again, conjecture, but it just tells me that these stories need to be told together, right? Gutenberg, as well as this wave of migration, are related, I think.
You talk about Gutenberg using his sort of his Latin texts. How much of these early printed texts that you've been working on can be linked to Latin?
Actually, I haven't found printed Latin, but the language, I should say, of these strangers. So they had a lingua franca. So each group, you know, had a, like the Romani spoke Roma, of course, the Dome spoke Domari, etc. So they all had local, maybe tribal languages, we could call them. And their lingua franca was something called Sine. And Sine it's a little like Yiddish. So, you know, Yiddish has this grammar that's German, and then the vocabulary is German, but also Hebrew, and it has some Romani in it too. And so Sine has an Arabic grammar base, and it has vocabulary from Latin, from Arabic, from Persian. And then there's a stratum of vocabulary that I cannot identify. And I haven't met anyone, you know, that a collaborator cannot identify either. So it's probably, you know, an older language. We just don't know. So they seem to have, so for instance, I think the word for donkey is Zill. And, you know, it's related to the German, you know, Isel. They were certainly circulating in Roman communities and, you know, Eastern Mediterranean communities and picking up a little bit of Latin. But actually, to this day, I don't know of printed Latin, unfortunately. But they did print Greek, that's for sure.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
There is a statement in a 14th century work by a Syrian who claims to have traveled most of his life with the strangers, in which he says that he talks about their salons, their literary salons. He says they're very hierarchical. And there's a clear hierarchy in the stranger community. You know, the literate peoples are at the top of this hierarchy. So the preachers, you know, the printers. And at the bottom of the hierarchy are those who collect the garbage in the street.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You talked about the Roma communities and how they moved through, moved through Europe. How much are we able to recover of their history because they were so itinerant in this period?
We can recover quite a lot about it. I'm actually quite surprised because there's not a very robust engagement with Romani history, I would say, among Europeanist medievalists. But, I mean, we can certainly trace their routes. We can trace Duke Michael's specific band of Romani people, maybe about 100 people in total, as they circulate from, you know, southern Germany up to the Baltic, up to the North Sea. But the fact is that because they're often recorded in local town chronicles, their arrival certainly caused a stir. They were, you know, they were loud. They performed, you know, they did acrobatic performances in the fish markets, and they did fortune telling. I mean, they were, you know, they made an impression. So thankfully, that's good for historians because, you know, wherever they went, someone noticed it. So I think what we learn about them is, you know, they, I mean, some small things like, you know, they dress differently. We know a lot about their dress, that they pierce their ears, they pierce their children's ears, that they lived outdoors, they sold horses. They seem to be very expert on horse trading, and fortune telling and begging. So those three features of their culture, which, you know, is also apparent in the Middle Eastern sources, were strong, you know, anchors of their communities.
Do you get much information about them from the Middle Eastern sources? Some of the texts, for example?
Oh, yes. Actually, I mean, they're very rich. In fact, because a lot of them are authored by these strangers. So that's the difference. I'm not predominantly European, so I don't work on those sources so much. But in Arabic and in Sindh, we have so many medieval sources. So that's been really rich for me. There are a number of didactic poems written by these strangers in which they try to explain their Sindh language to Arabs. So it's in Arabic, it's interspersed with Sindh, and then it's glossed in Arabic to explain these Sindh terms. There are also performative plays. I mean, there's a 14th century or 13th century play by Ibn Daniel that was created in Cairo, in which he, you know, it's basically a parade of figures from the strangers' community. So, you know, the fortune tellers, the astrologers, the lion tamers, the elephant tamers, the cat trainers, you know, all of these kind of circus figures and charlatans and printers. So for the most part, they've been understood as tricksters and clowns in my field's literature. And so that's helped us to overlook the fact that they were propagating, you know, technology that a lot of us today would say was crucial, right, for the spread of literacy and things like that. But so there is actually a lot about them, I should say, in Arabic.
Yeah. And how do you think these people are presented as part of a wider understanding of the medieval world? I mean, you know, particularly within our sort of broader understanding of medieval global history.
Well, I mean, just working on this project, I had to reorient myself to my own subject so many times. The book was years late, and partly for that reason. I mean, everything I thought I knew, and this is no exaggeration, I had to revisit. I had to revisit biases around what constituted a language, because their Sindh lingua franca was, first, we didn't know that the language was called Sindh. That was something I found out, but was described as a beggar's cant or a thieves cant. Usually it wasn't treated like with any sort of dignity. I also had to reimagine what a Romani person was. I had to, you know, deconstruct the fact that, you know, this is a very modern construction and no one identified by these very specific linguistic categories in the period I'm looking at. Even as you hear when they come to Europe, they call themselves Egyptians, right? So they have a very different self-identification. But what it tells us about the Middle Ages, and again, this is an entire group of people that had been overlooked as a serious group in my field, was that, you know, the modern present does not map easily onto the past. And I think, you know, we tend to do that as historians. In my field, we focus on, you know, the sectarian differences, really, you know, Jewish, Christian, Muslims in the past. And that's it. You know, I mean, we do a little bit, we really haven't interrogated African enslavement in any serious way, the Roma, et cetera. So I think it's broadened our conception of what was possible. And also, we have to imagine who brought so-called civilization to whom, right? I mean, these were roaming hordes, you know, in the Middle East and in Europe. And we tend to associate nomadic peoples not with civilization. You know, civilization is sedentary. And so I think a lot of these categories just have to be reimagined. And also the story of European early modernity, too, might have to be reimagined. It is a story that's told predominantly from, you know, the printing press onward. And I think the story could be backdated, right, to 1417 and then early printing, then the printing press. So I think we have to reimagine a lot of the past.
Yeah, I mean, in the last 20 minutes or so, you've mentioned languages and cultures that I think so many people wouldn't have even know existed. Surely that, in the process, in the course of your research, was that a problem for you, sort of trying to recover some of these languages and trying to work out what they were, who they belonged to? And even you mentioned that you didn't even know that Sindh was the name of a language. How did you move through these problems in your research? Because they are quite significant, to the point where I think many historians would have somewhat given up.
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge. Maybe it was late, the book was late because I partly did give up. I mean, to say the different cultures that it was an education. I have to say, I think what I really like about being a professor is that, you know, you're humbled all the time, you know, sometimes in the classroom, a lot of times just in, you know, in archives, you know, you can't read something on your own or, you know, trying to analyze a text. So this was an incredibly humbling experience. I would hope that if this book is read and taught, that it encourages us to just not feel so settled in our assumptions about knowledge, right? I mean, that we really don't know a lot. And that's what really, you know, I do think I have a strong handle on the canon, you know, the medieval canon of my field. And this just overturned just about everything I'd assumed. I mean, just directions of influence, who was literate in the period. You know, we really focus on people who wrote books. And I think that focus on book production comes out of our own, you know, we both have books in our households. I mean, you know, we make books, we write books. I know you write books. So, you know, we also want to look into the past and kind of valorize our present by seeing who was doing that and where did that start. But, you know, it's also printing, you know, it's ephemera, it's pamphlets, it's smaller material too that pushes history forward. And I think, yeah, the reorientation to history would be my key takeaway.
Yeah. Can I ask, you know, when faced with some of these texts, because thinking about a historian's process, and especially a historian who is dealing with some of these very early texts I would look at it and feel like it was code that you were trying to transcribe. How would you look to other languages? So, for example, you've mentioned some things were in Greek. Were there influences in some of the, minority languages like Sine that were taking influences from some of the more understood languages like Arabic or Greek or Hebrew that you were able to use to be able to apply to some of the more complex ones?
The morphology of Sine verbs follows the morphology of Persian verbs. So that was helpful to know Persian. So I don't have all of the languages of that, you know, that influenced Sine. I wish I did. And of course, the Arabic grammar, I do have the Arabic. So that helped me get through it, to decode it, I should say. But otherwise, you know, I will have to say I'm sure that there are others with different specialties. I mean, one of my regrets going through this project is that I don't have any Southern European, like Balkan languages, Southeastern European languages, and that would probably have helped a lot. Of course, this is a prolegomena to further research. I did not write, you know, the last text on the Roma, medieval Roma or medieval Sine, and I do hope it's taken up and expanded. It is so interesting, a group of people, these strangers, because they come from basically everywhere in Asia and Southeastern Europe and North Africa, that I don't think one person could get through it. So I do look forward to collaborations in the future or future work. Yeah.
Do you think that the medieval Roma communities have been marginalized to the point where we were in danger of losing some of their histories?
I think actually that preservation of their works has been remarkably robust. I think the real issue has been, whom do we take seriously in the past, right? I mean, would it have to be someone who had a formal education through a Quranic school and studied under a known teacher? Or is it someone who, you know, preached on the sidewalks, in the alleys and on the streets of the past? So I think it's there. I think there's a lot more than I was able to find. I mean, in my book, there was one chapter on a poet from Mamluk Cairo who I believe was a stranger, and who he said so in his poetry. And he also included Sine, you know, blocks of Sine in his poetry and lived in the neighborhood where the strangers lived. No one else lived there. So, you know, that was also the giveaway. Like, okay, this was the neighborhood no one else went to. So I think there's more there. I think there's a literate culture, oral manuscript and print culture that really needs to be excavated. And it's not impossible. It just, you know, there has to be a will, but it's there.
It's interesting you talk about the oral histories with that, because we mentioned earlier that so much of the recorded text is religious, whereas actually some of the oral histories were likely to be more stories and things with sort of a narrative of times and mythologies, etc. Would you say that there is an ability to look into that further, or do you think that that's a history that is probably lost to us now?
As for the oral culture, I mean, there is a statement in a 14th century work by a Syrian who claims to have traveled most of his life with the strangers, in which he says that he talks about their salons, their literary salons. He says they're very hierarchical. And there's a clear hierarchy in the stranger community. You know, the literate peoples are at the top of this hierarchy. So the preachers, you know, the printers. And at the bottom of the hierarchy are those who collect the garbage in the street. Again, urban streets. But yeah, so there's a hierarchy. And so, you know, they speak in that order. And he says that they produce poetry and scene. I do hope one day, you know, when every time I read about a manuscript that has an indecipherable text or a language, you know, I'm always thinking, you know, in Arabic script, for instance, I'll think, okay, is that scene? And you know, I'll go to it and check. I wonder if someone transcribed something in scene, because we have lots of transcriptions of scene that have usually been described in the sources as indecipherable Arabic or faulty Arabic, or, you know, a scribe who didn't know anything, you know. So I think it's there. We have to just, so at the back of the book, I have a glossary so we can, you know, we can start to teach students how to recognize this other language. It's like, it's there and it influenced so much. So we should really get into that.
It's wonderful to be at the grassroots of this research in a way, isn't it? Because then you can actually kind of, you know, you're paving the way for other historians to go forward and find all of these secret texts. Where do you see your research being placed within a global history context? And, you know, what is it that you're hoping to achieve by recovering these minority literary communities?
Wow. Well, I think first and foremost, I think we need a global counterpart. And these are the words of Kenneth Pomerantz, but a global counterpart to Elizabeth Eisenstein's History of Early Print. And I think this is something I would like to work on, like with, you know, a dream team of medievalists, you know, from the Korean Peninsula to, I guess, yeah, Iberia, in which we really try to reconstruct and not, I mean, Gutenberg would be proud of this question, obviously, but I mean, but to also situate him in a broader context and to see, you know, how the Buddhists brought this to the Middle Easterners, how they brought it. I think that would be important. And I think that's a key question for also how the public sphere begins in Europe. Was there public sphere in the Middle East, maybe around these printed texts? I think there's so many questions. Was movable type used in Arabic? I was not able to answer that myself. Maybe the answer is no, but I also think, you know, we really haven't asked that question. So I'd like to do that. I also think it would be interesting to have a real study of these travelers. I mean, to really have a subfield in the medieval studies, of just traveling peoples, and not in a way that, you know, that infantilizes them or treats them as clowns or beggars who have nothing to offer, but, you know, really understand why people chose to beg. You know, what were the freedoms that actually come from people who don't have to borrow money or who don't have to pay taxes on said earnings? And also astrology as a faith. So I do lightly argue that the strangers were not, I mean, they might have said they were Muslim or Jewish or Christian, but that a core faith that was really astrology, right? So belief in the planets and the stars as important factors and as also deified. So I think treating, you know, astrology as a serious faith tradition in the Middle Ages would also be a good direction which we could follow.
Thank you so much, Christina, and congratulations again on your very well-deserved prize.
Oh, thank you so much, Helen. Thank you for the conversation. It was really, really a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening. That was Dr. Christina Richardson. She's Associate Professor of History at Queen's College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Christina was speaking to the author, broadcaster, and public historian, Helen Carr. Christina is one of the winners of this year's Dan David Prize, the world's largest history prize, which recognises outstanding historical scholarship. If you'd like to hear more conversations between Helen and other winners of the Dan David Prize, you can access the whole collection early and ad-free now at historyextra.com/Dan-David-Prize. And you can find out more about the Dan David Prize, including their events and the other winners, at dandavidprize.org.